Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by Eugene Gershman, CEO of GIS Development Corporation, a family-built real estate development firm based in Seattle. Eugene didn't just build a company, he built it with family. Together with his sister and brother-in-law, and guided by his father, he's transformed GIS from a kitchen table startup into a $30 million enterprise focused on partnership-driven real estate and long-term legacy creation. Through economic booms, market downturns, and the challenges of managing a multi-generational team, Eugene has stayed true to the values of loyalty, transparency, and purpose, believing that real estate isn't just about capital gains, but about creating generational wealth and community impact. Eugene, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Ed, thank you so much. Pleasure being here. Thanks for that awesome intro.
You're very welcome. Hey, take us back to the beginning. What was it like growing up around your father's business, and how did those early experiences shape your understanding of what it means to be an entrepreneur?
Oh God, I hated it. Growing up, I'm like, I would never be a builder. Seeing him stressed out all the time, always angry, always on edge, I'm like, no, please keep me as far away from that thing as possible. Honestly, I think obviously our past makes who we are today, right? So that experience was invaluable. Seeing all that stress, seeing what he built from literally nothing was on the one hand, super inspiring. On the other hand, was almost cautionary because like I'm growing up, I'm like, how do I achieve even remotely close level of success on my own without being that stressed out? And I think the biggest lesson is you have to be like 100% in whatever you're doing to get those results. But
you weren't alone back in the day, because I'm on record saying in line for graduation to one of my best friends, I said, Mike, I'm not sure what I'm going to do next, but I'll be damned if I go to work for my old man. And right? A few months later, I'm turning down a job to go work in the family business, and a few years later, buying them out.
Exactly.
But yes, because I saw the same thing you did, Eugene, a lot of that stress and a lot of that anxiety that sometimes comes along with business ownership and leadership. But anyway,
the cliche, we work hard, we play hard. It is true. We've gone on nice vacations. We've spent a lot of quality family time. Traveling was awesome, my sister and me. But it did cost him his health. He's, thank God, alive and well, but definitely not as young and energetic as he used to be 30 years ago. But sure. It's funny. So I graduated from college. I had a degree in economics. I knew that I don't want to be a builder. I didn't go into engineering. I was an inspiring computer geek, but quickly realized that computer science was not for me. That was for people that clearly are not from this planet. Economics gave me the broad enough education where I'm like, all right, finance world seems attractive. I seem to understand it, and that's what I want to do. And so after graduation, I went to work for this little financial services firm. I was running retirement projections. I got my Series 7 here in the Seattle area. We like to joke that we're going to be stockbrokers because we would only see stockbrokers in movies. But we had CNBC run it on a background, and that seemed to be like that would be the career path.
Yeah.
Very quickly, 2-3 years later, I got bored running Excel models for old folks. And I said, I'm still young, let me just go back to school. And so I signed up for the evening MBA program here at the University of Washington. My last year of MBA, my dad calls me. He's like, I've got this project. It's got a lot of financial documents that I don't really know how to understand. It's an opportunity for us to join a development team as a contractor and maybe learn development and branch out, maybe open a branch office of our company. Do you mind taking a look at the financials? Because I don't understand them, and you could help me interpret them. I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. And I was my last year, I've taken a few finance classes, so I've been exposed to some complex financial models by then, and it was a real estate pro forma analysis. So I looked at that. It was most sophisticated, most complicated pro forma I've ever seen by then. College courses and simple models would not even compare. But that was my first experience. So I reviewed it, took me a few days, called them back. I'm like, based on my limited experience, it looks cool. It's definitely a cool model. If assuming all the data, all the assumptions check out, then, you know, it does look like an attractive project. So I'm expecting to meet with the potential partners here in the next few days. Do you mind joining me at the meeting? Since you've seen the numbers, maybe you could help me interpret them. And so I'm like, yeah, sure, okay, whatever. So I joined the meeting, and I've been telling the story many times on the different podcasts. I'm not going to go into the full details, but long story short, 3 or 4 meetings later, few phone calls, conference calls, he says, all right, I guess we're doing this deal. We're going to open up a branch office. He goes, I'm going to have to hire a bunch of people, and it would be nice to have somebody here to help oversee things. He goes, I wish I could just have somebody that I could trust. I'm like, okay, fine. And so the rest, as they say, is history. I joined the family business. That was my first experience. The project actually didn't go anywhere. I spent about, I want to say, 9 months, 10 months pursuing this. And then the partners had challenges with permits, and the project ended up being shut down. But now that I've been sucked into the family business, Dad goes, what's next? Let's look at the next deal. And so that's how we started evolving from a general contractor to a real estate developer. And yeah, later on, he has retired, and my sister and I and brother-in-law were basically running the show.
So talk about that for a minute, Eugene. Just give us some context. Your sister is older sister, younger sister?
Younger.
Younger. Okay. So you were involved, and then she came into the business after you. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And then at some point, your brother-in-law joined as well, or at the same time? Were they a package, or did they come separately?
They were not married at the time. So it's funny. Me growing up, I was like, I'm never going to join family business. That's not for me. Like, construction, keep me away. Her growing up, she always knew, like, going through college, she majored in business, and she's, I want to learn business because I'm going to go join Dad's business. That was her path. She knew that's what she would do.
Okay.
Wow. So when she graduated, I was already on board. She graduated. I think that she started part-time at first. I forget the timeline there exactly, but yeah, fairly shortly after her graduation, she joined full-time. And then her husband has been, or future husband at the time, he was helping us out here and there. Like, he was a well-connected guy, knew a lot of people, still knows a ton of people, and keeps in touch with everybody, which is amazing. But so he, and which is why he's more on our business development side, but he slowly, I don't know, slowly, one step after another, became a part of the company. And yeah, she majored, or her business school concentration was marketing. So that was her thing. When she joined the company, she would focus on marketing. And then when they got married, he had a few jobs here and there. But then after a little while, we needed help growing the business. We needed help making connections. And so he joined the business full time.
Excellent. Excellent. Now you leave the company. So your sister, so she's still in marketing capacity, or has her role changed over time?
It changed. Definitely. She's taken on pretty much every facet right now. It's funny because I do all of these podcast appearances and my name appears on a lot of our marketing literature. Our roles almost flipped. I do more marketing and she does more of the overall operations. But yeah, we kind of leveled ourselves out to describe ourselves as principals. I guess my official title is CEO, but because we're small and lean, at one point we became quite a bit larger. We had construction operations. We had 30 plus people in the company. So we had to differentiate responsibilities. Recently, we contracted and regrouped and focused solely on development. And so we do a lot of things as a small team.
I see. And your brother-in-law is more of a business development capacity. Is that his role?
More so in business development. Okay. But again, there's certain aspects where he is better than others. And so he would take on some project management tasks. He, you know, in a small team, it's so much easier. Hierarchy is not that important.
Okay. So the three of you are somewhat nimble in terms of your roles. They're not super delineated. It's, you lean certain ways, but you will bounce a little bit in terms of functions and roles based
absolutely.
on need. Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. What's it like then if you're all sitting down at the family gathering, let's say? Can you put business on the table, or is business stay off the table if you're at a holiday event or some other family gathering? How does it work in your family, Eugene?
All the freaking time. In fact, my daughter recently said, whatever you guys do, I don't want to be part of the family business, because all you do is you always talk about work. She's like, I want to be able to talk about other things and not just work when I come home. And I'm like, it is what it is. Sometimes you have to spend time talking about work. Sometimes there's nothing else to talk about, so we're like, oh, may as well cover some of the things. But no, we try to be more responsible about it. Mm-hmm. Try not to abuse the how do I put it, the goodwill of our other family members. But a lot of times it's inevitable, especially when really bad things are happening or really good things are happening. When it's just mundane, nobody cares.
Yeah.
But when there's like massive stress, you have to talk about it.
That's usually the stuff you bring home, unfortunately, right? When it's really high or really low, the middle stuff, it's, you know, who celebrates vanilla ice cream? Nobody.
Right. Exactly.
But I understand the sentiment, because I have twins. They're currently in college. And when I've probed them about any interest in being Generation 3 here, they're like, no, because I see how you're always talking about work and this and that. And it just reminds me that much like you and I were influenced by our folks, they are too. And maybe not always for the good. As it relates to the business.
The way I explain it to them, and you, between different kids, you see the personalities. I don't know how it is with twins, though, because I have three. They're all about 4 years apart, older girls and younger boy. And so we try to decipher their personality traits early on and who would be the candidate to join the business versus not. And I don't know, they still see the good and the bad. And yeah, sometimes it's annoying to have to talk about work at the dinner table. Yeah. But at the same time, I'd rather discuss a work problem than talk about religion or politics. So there's that.
There you go. Being in real estate and development certainly has its cycles, right? There's high cycles, there's low cycles. Across your tenure, now that you've gone more all in from construction into real estate development, how do you manage the highs and lows? Like, I think there was, at least on the commercial side, that was down a couple of years ago, right? In 23, that was a tough year for commercial. But how do you navigate some of those highs and lows?
I'm writing a book right now, because every time you recover from a low, you gain a new experience and you gain new knowledge. And with the knowledge that I have today, I probably would have acted differently 8 years ago. But two years ago was really bad. 2022, 23, post-COVID inflation, interest rate hikes. It was a nightmare for us. We lost a ton of money. We contracted. We experienced a lot of trouble. And now we're recovering with new energy, new desire to conquer the world and try to make a dent on solving the housing crisis. It's tough. The biggest lesson that I've learned, and what's funny, you learn all these lessons in school. I went to business school. I majored in economics. I got my MBA. Yes, I've learned those lessons from textbooks, but all of those textbooks are useless until you actually physically live through them. And biggest lesson I've learned is do not borrow too much money. Some of our projects were way too highly leveraged. I would never advise anybody to do that. Yes, many people made a shit ton of money during that growth cycle by building deals with zero down, because they would find investors or lenders that would finance 100% of their operations. And it's like musical chairs. Music stopped, some found a chair and some didn't. Another thing that this latest spin reminded me is that in construction, especially, I was raised in the family of a builder. So what do builders focus on? The builders focus on having the foundation, building the frame, bringing all the trades, like managing the project, actually building stuff. What builders frequently forget to focus on is that after you build stuff, you're going to have to sell it. And that was the biggest reminder for me over the last couple of years. I'm like, crap, our marketing has been dismal, like almost non-existent. My sister had a degree in marketing. I have taken so many marketing courses, but when you dive into a family established business, you're being told to continue doing what the company has been doing before because it worked. The world is changing, the world is evolving. And that was the biggest realization for me, is that we have to evolve with the world. And while it is important to make sure that the product is built, that the product is delivered, you cannot forget that at some point you're going to have to sell it.
Yeah.
And sell the product or sell the business, sell the service, all of those things. So marketing and sales, that was another big wake up for us, is that we have not dedicated enough time and energy on marketing and sales to continue growing the business.
An important realization. Let's talk about, it was probably a bold move and a big move to ultimately shut down the construction arm of the business. But it was also somewhat, as you previously described when we first spoke, somewhat of a liberation of the business as well, because I think you were largely tied to regionalized markets. But if you could talk, Eugene, what led up to that decision and what was it like working through that to say, okay, we're going this direction? And then ultimately, how'd you know it was the right time? Just talk about that for a moment.
So the biggest challenge running a construction company in late 2010s and early 2020s, especially here in the Pacific Northwest, has been availability of labor.
What's that?
Availability of labor.
Availability.
Skilled labor, unskilled labor, professional management. We were struggling with project managers. We were struggling with superintendents. We were struggling with the field personnel. We were struggling finding subcontractors. And what ended up happening was I decided many years ago, probably in around 2010-ish, that the company is going to pivot and focus more on real estate development rather than being a fee-based contractor. And so my mental focus has been on development, but my time has been consumed by managing the construction operations. And maybe that was part of our problem, is because my energy wasn't there. And we let that side slip, and we couldn't staff it up in such a way that it would become self-sustained. And our goal has been to have construction company fully sustained, self-sustained, not having to rely on the business brought in by the development company, to have its own book of business. But we never allocated enough resources to build that. Our resources, our personal resources, and our personal time has been focused on the development side of the business. And I think that in the end was what made it easy to shut it down, because the company just collapsed. We didn't allow it to grow. We didn't allow it to maintain that level of growth. When my father was running the company, he was the one procuring the business. He was the business development. He never did any marketing. That was part of the reason it was almost frowned upon when we joined the business. When we talked to him about marketing, he's like, just get out of here, go print a brochure or something. to him, a marketing construction company was knocking on doors and talking to people and developing relationships and getting business that way. I don't know if I answered the question, but the market cycle helped us close it down. The company simply collapsed in the end. So
was your dad on board with it? He started the business as a more of a purist construction firm. Now it's starting, although albeit he was the one that was intrigued by this idea of a development project that ultimately brought you into the business. So he at least was thinking that way. Was he remorseful though? Did he feel a sense of loss of the origins of the company had now really shifted from where they were to where they were going?
He did. But here's the funny part. For years, he's been telling me to get rid of the construction company.
Really?
It's the most dirtiest, the most stressful business you could ever find. He was always a fan of manufacturing. He's find a manufacturing business to invest in. I'm like, Dad, I know nothing about manufacturing. I can't manufacture anything. Like, I don't even know where to start. Like, I would have to learn the business from the beginning.
Yeah.
And buying an established business is risky because we don't know how to run it, how to evaluate it even. He still blames me for not finding a manufacturing business to invest in and run. But he definitely felt sad that we had to shut it down, because it's a piece of history, something that he started. But at the same time, he was glad, because he always wanted the company to grow and evolve and branch out geographically and branch out energetically. He was always entrepreneurial. Over the years, during the GFC, we invested in a bunch of stupid businesses. Now, looking back, when a lot of times when we talk about it, I'm like, Dad, we burned so much money between 2009 and 2012 on stupid projects because real estate wasn't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Construction wasn't really happening. And we had two tech startups. We invested some money in artificial diamond research production. We had a bunch of side projects. We made a freaking movie. Instead, I'm like looking back, I'm like, man, we should have been buying land. Like if we had a little bit extra cash, we should have been buying land back then. But so yeah, he's glad that part is done. And yeah. He wants us to focus on what he calls a cleaner business. But it's definitely every time, even if you move out of the old house into a bigger, better home, you still feel nostalgia. And that's how it felt.
But you didn't pivot too far afield, and you still stayed in a general channel that's relatable in some levels, as opposed to saying, we're going to shut this down and open up a chain of restaurants or something. That's right. A little bit of a departure.
Exactly. What I tell people too is that because I ran a construction company, I know how to work with contractors. Mm-hmm. I know what questions to ask. I know when they give me a budget. A lot of times, like just recently, we were looking at a new project and the owner sent me their construction budget. And he says, look, this is a fixed price contract from the local builder. I look at it, I'm like, it's great, but I would never sign this contract. Mm-hmm. And I gave him like a laundry list of questions, but I'm like, there's not enough here. You're asking for change orders. You're going to drown in change orders because there's so many unknowns in this contract. Mm. And so that experience gives me that little bit of an extra edge because I've been on both sides of the equation.
Yeah. And anybody that's involved with either new construction or a major project or even a major renovation or remodeling effort knows that those costs could vary greatly from firm to firm, usually based on experience and expertise. Somebody that's cutting their teeth on something, doesn't really know what they're doing, might be bidding higher to cover that learning curve, whereas somebody that's maybe done it, seen it before, might be more competitive because they're like, we know this building, we know this project, we know how to do this type of work or whatever it might be.
Right, exactly.
And that helps to have that insight. Shifting gears a bit here a little bit. So many leaders, many we've had on the show talk about purpose, but you've kind of lived it. So Eugene, you kind of shifted from a grow at all costs types of mindset to one built around values. Can you talk for a minute about that? What triggered that sort of transformation from being purely growth minded to being more values driven for you personally?
I think the biggest motivator for me is seeing the buildings that we worked on completed. And seeing people live there. And when I experience people living in the buildings that we built, makes me want to continue that process of innovation and bringing in little details, little nuances into the homes that most other builders don't think about. It's rare. We're uniquely, I don't know, fortunate. We remain friends with one family who we built a custom home for a few years ago. And so we frequently visit the house and look around. And still, every time I visit there, it brings a smile to my face because I've seen this at just raw land. It was pretty wooded, forested area. Then we cut the trees. Then I saw the empty field. Then I saw the hole dug. Then I saw the concrete. Then I saw the framing. Mm-hmm. Every little detail of that home has been thought through. But then we visit typical spec homes that are built time and time again, and people buy them, and it's all the same thing, your typical white shaker cabinets and your barnhouse sink and or barn doors and farmhouse sinks and all the typical things that you see in every other new home. And I'm like, it needs something. And so that drive, even when we're developing workforce apartments, I still want to add a few little nice touches where people that experience it, they would know that this product is different. I don't know, that maybe it's silly, but
I don't think it's silly at all. I think that's great. I remember we had moved into a new area and I went for a run and I'm like, oh, that house is nice, because I'll kind of look at houses and that one's nice and that one's, and I realized, oh, there it is again and again. And after running, like, Oh, they're just repeating. It's the same thing
Exactly.
repeated every five houses or so. I'm like, wow, this is not good at all.
Exactly. Exactly. And nothing wrong
This is
with that.
boring.
When you're building hundreds of homes, you're going to see that. And we do a typical apartment building would easily have 150, 200 units in it. And there's going to be a lot of repeating
Well, that's
elements. But
different. Yeah. When it's a multi-family type of scenario or an apartment or a condo or a townhouse, you'd expect that. But when it's standalone homes, it's like you want to see a little bit of,
slightly, yeah, and beyond
originality
just
or,
the color variation, like at least little touches. And
something.
a lot of times builders ignore little things. Like we were at a friend's house, it was a couple of years ago, and they wanted me to give them an opinion of the quality build of the house. And it was a very nice high-end home. And I looked around and I'm like, I can tell that this was a spec-built house. It's very well built. You've got very nice high-end finishes, very expensive appliances, but there are a few little details that I can pick up with my eye that you guys probably would never notice. So I'm like, do you really want me to tell you? Because if I tell you, you're not going to be able to unsee that. And like little things, when the light switch and the receptacle would not line up, like they would be just slightly off. Most people never notice that. But in a nice custom home, you would to see some symmetry there. And that's the little detail, little nuance that I like bringing to projects when we work on them.
That's awesome. That's great. So let me ask you about taking over from your dad. A lot of times that's a tricky navigation for multi-generational businesses where the next generation is stepping up, which means that the previous generation needs to step back or even let go. Was there a point where your dad struggled to relinquish the reins to you and your sister and brother-in-law, or was that a fairly fluid transition in your case?
All the time. And even today, even though he's not involved in day-to-day operations, we would chat at least, we talk multiple times a week, but at least once a week, we would have the conversation would turn to work and what's happening at work. And he can't help himself but to give advice, which I appreciate. But a lot of times, I'm telling him about something that's happening at work, and he switches. He gets into this mode. Here's what you got to do. You got to do this and that. And I'm like, okay, cool. Thanks. He's like, seriously, write it down. Like, you first got to call
Right
that
down.
person, then you got to call that person, then you got to do this. I'm like, okay, I got it. And to this day, I get annoyed and I recognize it's the way he built the business, and he'll never be able to switch that off. But it's the teenager in me that keeps saying, just get off my back. I know what I'm doing. And maybe sometimes now, that I'm 47, looking back, I'm like, shit, I maybe should have listened to him more when I was younger.
It's tough, right? Because they have a lot of wisdom, right? A lot of experience, and you can't discount that. However, things change, right? And not only the generational change in your organization, but certainly that's reflected in the outside world. There's a whole new class of prospective buyers. There's a whole new class of construction firms rising up. There's new trends impacting how things are built and what people want and are looking for out of a physical space. So everything changes. That needs to be factored in as well. And that can be, I've seen it a lot where that previous generation has a bit of a hard time fully letting go. Yet in your case, you've mentioned your family's dynamic is as close as it gets. So despite the fact that there's some of that generational shift, if you will, you guys still manage to stay pretty tight. So how do you do that, Eugene? How do you maintain that closeness as a family when, you're in an industry where there can be a lot of stress and anxiety and tension relative to putting an engagement or a deal together or a project?
I think fairly early on, we established that there is going to be tension and there will be times when we're mad at each other and we would have fights and we would all of us would be yelling at each other and would get super mad. And we can't avoid that. We can't control it. It just emotions, especially when things go wrong, when project goes bad or when something bad happens, it's inevitable. There's going to be tension. But the way we have always done with it is we'd let it out, we'd finish yelling, hang up the phones or walk out of the room if it was in person. And 24 hours later, we would be getting together for some family function or some other event or talk to each other because we needed to talk to each other. And we rarely apologize. We rarely go back and rehash how we got there. We just move on because I think we all recognize that we get emotional. Sometimes people overreact over stupid things, and we're still family. And no matter what, we keep marching forward. Now, my wife worked with me for a little bit of time, and she couldn't handle it.
Okay.
She said, look, I can't get it. I need to switch off. I need to be able to do other things. Like, I can't be always in this mode. But funny enough, I used to spend more time with my sister because we'd work together than I would spend with my wife and kids. Literally, we'd be at the office for sometimes 10 hours a day, and we'd be working on things. And then I would come home and I would see my wife for 2 hours and then go to bed. But I don't know. Recently, after the whole work from home dynamics shifted a little bit, we don't see each other that much. We still talk all the time, of course. But interestingly enough, when we don't see each other a lot, there is less of that friction. When we're in each other's faces, I think that's when emotions would come back and some of the maybe tension, some of the antagonism, maybe some of the power struggle would show its face more frequently. But I don't know. If I were to give advice to another family business, is learn to understand quickly that it's going to happen. You can't avoid it. And the best thing to do is just recognize, remember that you're still family no matter what. Even if the business blows up tomorrow, you're still family.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you raised so many great points in that. That was a great one that you ended on. But even this idea that there's the family members often that are working within the family business unit, and then there's lots of ancillary family members. And they often have, if not maybe a stake, they certainly have a say. And they oftentimes bear the brunt of hearing about all kinds of things.
Right.
And I think that's something that all of us that are in that family business dynamic have to respect, that there's the family members in the business and those outside the business. And you have to respect all parties for the good of the family. That's for sure. And sometimes they'll have very strong and spirited opinions about things.
And look, it's not that we didn't have our own history of challenges. We've had some extended family that work with us for the time being, and then they didn't. And some friends that work with us, and then we stopped being friends because of various different dynamics. And I don't know who's at fault. If you ask each party, they would have their own side of the story. But that is why some people say, hey, don't work with friends and family. It's never going to end well.
Yeah, and I've heard all signs of that. Some people say, do it, it's great. And some people say, run for the hills.
Exactly. I don't know. Maybe we were lucky. At least between my sister and me, we were able to remain civil. We still see each other on kids' birthdays and each other's birthdays and holidays and Thanksgiving. And I don't know. I guess everybody has to decide for themselves. But for us, it just worked.
That's great. That's great. So another area, what I'd love to hear your thoughts on is, and this comes up a lot, where the next generation is looking to take the reins and they're recognizing, as you did, even though maybe the wheels were in motion, but ultimately that we've got to modernize, we've got to pivot, we've got to do things that we haven't done before. We've got to flex and find new muscles that we haven't worked before, whether they be in sales and marketing or in other avenues. What advice might you give to, say, a next gen leader who's struggling with that? They really want to advance the business, but they don't, they're either being held back by the founder or they don't want to alienate that person because of that respect. That might be a mother or a father or some other family member that was the founder and therefore is due that respect for starting that initial spark that started it all. That comes from somewhere. So you don't want to alienate that or be dismissive of that, but you still got to move forward into the next generation in the now. So somebody that's often a struggle for a second, sometimes even a third or fourth gen, how might you give them a little piece of advice for how to navigate those situations?
Okay, so I think I would first recognize that if the business has been in existence for several years, no matter what you think about what's right or wrong about it, something must have been right because it was surviving and thriving for all this time. So you have to recognize that despite your disagreement about the future, whatever's been done up to this point, at least some of it must have been right. And then spend some time in the business, trying to understand every single facet of it. If you're straight out of college, like I was, joining a business, and maybe that was partially my mistake too. I didn't spend enough time in the field. I didn't spend enough time learning every department, every division of our company. I got placed into the finance, accounting, legal world outside of the operations. I knew what the operations was doing, but I wasn't very much involved in it. So I would say definitely study and understand why business operates the way it does. And then if you have ideas for how to implement a change or what to do different, I would say you always have to figure out small ways how to test it out. Because you know what? Not everything that they teach us in college is right. Not every idea that you learn on the internet or by watching somebody else is replicatable. And I'm sure the previous generation is not just going to flat out rule out this idea because you brought it. There's always a way to demonstrate and test and maybe do a small test case to see if your innovation or your change or your new direction is worth it. But yeah, but I think the key is to truly know the business and truly experience it. And you can't do that by sitting in the office. You can't do that by having even weekly meetings. You actually have to spend a few years in each department, learning the trade, actually doing things so that then you could begin to really know what it's about and if there's a better way to do what they're doing.
Yeah. And I've definitely, having the show for some time and talking to so many guests, I definitely start to see some patterns showing up about the differences between that first gen and a next gen. A first gen tends to be rather authoritative and top-down leader, whereas second gens are, I think we tend to be a bit more collaborative. You know, we want to hear more sides of things. We're not always accepting that, hey, if you tried something in the past and it failed, it's going to fail again today because circumstances may have changed. And I think you're living proof, Eugene, of collaboration. You've got you, your sister, and your brother-in-law working side by side, working effectively, understanding each other's strengths, and having that sort of familial agility to say, you handle this and I'll handle this, and it's all going to be okay. And also the emotional stamina to say, hey, even if sometimes we don't agree, we're still family. We're going to be okay.
And I think you're bringing up a good point about the collaborative versus the top-down authoritarian approach. And it's my father never went to school to learn how to run a construction company. He was an engineer, and he was a good leader, and he had a lot of leadership and management experience working random jobs before he started the company. But not random jobs, but advancing his career. But when I went to college, especially in business school, they would always say, they would try to instill this collaborative approach and saying that a group always, at least in studies, has performed better than individual authoritative leader. I think the counter to that is a lot of successful organizations have became that way because they had one authoritarian leader who said, do this. And they did it and they became successful. But how many others tried that same approach and failed? We don't know about them. We only know about success stories. We don't know about all the failures.
Very true.
So statistically speaking, this approach, and that's why it's taught in business schools, is more geared towards future growth. But could we have been growing better, faster, stronger if I ran the company the same way my dad did? Maybe, or maybe we would have been the statistics that nobody talks about.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's funny, when I was first starting out, I remember I was sitting down at some sort of a business function, and it was a consultant sitting next to me, and I told him, you know, what I did, and that I'm coming into the business and I'm going to be buying my father out. And he said, I had 85% of businesses fail from one generation to the next. So I'm like, oh, thanks, man. I needed to hear that.
Thanks for encouragement.
I got enough worries about what the heck I'm doing here. And now I'm saddled with that little statistic. But I think what we often are influenced, sometimes consciously, sometimes subconsciously. And it would seem that the businesses like yours, Eugene, and others that make that successful transfer, not only from one generation to the next, but even in your case, a pivot, industry speaking, there's that inherent tenacity. You know, we're going to keep going no matter what. And that shows up. And I feel the passion in just how you're talking about your business. And I'm sure that's evident in your sister and your brother-in-law, and most certainly your father. I think you all have that passion and that tenacity that's driving you. So that's awesome.
Thank you.
Another question. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you this, and this is always a fun one that I like to ask some guests, but if you can go back in time, right? So a younger Eugene who's just starting out, and you're to give him one piece of advice before embarking on that family business journey, what might that be? What would you tell a younger version of yourself now, looking back?
I would say to stop trying to become a leader right away. It sounds weird because most would encourage their children to be a leader early and learn the leadership role and be able to motivate people. But I think I've overdone it myself and tried to, and because I was the son of the founder, I came to the company, even though I wasn't senior enough, everybody still recognized who I am. So I felt that authority. What I would tell to myself is to humble down and go put on the boots and hard hat and actually go do some manual labor. Go talk to the folks in the field, understand how the business is actually done. Go out, sit in all of the outside meetings. I sit in pretty much all the meetings in the office. Like everybody knew who I am. I would go to accounting meetings. I would go to construction meetings. I would go to procurement, all departments. I would just sit and listen. But what I didn't do is I never spent time to shadow each department, and I never spent time in the field. I wish I actually spent more time in the field. Much later in my life, I think in my late 20s, I started doing some manual work at home because I was curious. I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn some basic carpentry skills because I never had that. I was always computer, telephone numbers. That was my thing. But I wish I learned that, the basic field work early on. And I think that would have helped me out.
Yeah, I think that's a great insight and a great piece of advice. Last question. If any of our listeners were really interested about learning more about you personally and your journey, or more about GIS Development Corp, what's the best way for them to connect with you?
Look me up on LinkedIn. That's probably the best thing. Eugene Gershman. I should be one of the first, if not the first, pop-up for you. Otherwise, GIS Companies in plural.co. No M in there. That's our website where we talk a lot about development, construction. We have a big blog section there. All of our podcasts are listed there. And then we have a ton of resources for developers who simply want to learn development and want to develop their property on their own. We've got a feasibility study checklist that they can download if they wanted to learn how to analyze their site. That's available for free. And then lastly, please check out my podcast, Real Estate Development Land to Legacy, where I talk to a lot of professionals about real estate development and all the challenges that we face and our success stories, what to do, what not to do.
Awesome. Wow, a wealth of resources. So thank you for that. And Eugene, thanks so much for sharing your story, for showing us how resilience, family values, and purpose can turn challenges into opportunities. Your perspective on legacy-driven leadership is certainly one every business leader and every listener can learn something from. Again, we've been speaking with Eugene Gershman, CEO of GIS Development Corporation, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Eugene, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ed. It's been my pleasure.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.delianet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeliaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.